Welcome to the program for Wednesday, December 21st, 2011 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour is always Pentagon Solutions, and that is a deep dive conversation series where I call on experts on defense issues, both inside and outside of DOD. They share ideas that leaders in the Pentagon and the contracting community can use to solve the big challenges the defense community faces. And the goal is to deliver information that will show you the path to those Pentagon solutions from people who are best equipped and most knowledgeable to provide those answers. Now, a lot has been made about sequestration, the process by which DOD and other agencies will experience budget cuts since the Supercommittee failed to agree on a package of negotiated cuts. Some of the rhetoric both for and against cutting the defense budget has been borderline inflammatory. The Center for Strategic and International Studies examined the facts behind sequestration and presented their findings as part of their Critical Questions series. You can read that linked up now on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The leaders of that research will be my guests on Pentagon Solutions today. David Berteau is Senior Vice President and Director of the International Security Program at CSIS. Ryan Crotty is a research assistant with CSIS's Defense Industrial Initiatives Group. Both men in studio with me today, and it's a pleasure to see both of you and have you on the program today. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
The title of this piece is Supercommittee Fallout and the Implications for Defense. And I think we've covered both at CSIS and on Federal News Radio ad nauseum the series of events that led to what is now possible in sequestration. Talk about specifically, I'll start with you, Dave, what is real and what is not real about some of the things that have been said so far about what sequestration will mean to DOD?
That's a great way to lead into it, because I think the key first point is what the Secretary of Defense himself has been saying, really since the time the Budget Control Act was passed last August. What he's saying is we can cut so far and no further without doing grave harm. In fact, as he calls it, tearing a seam in the fabric of defense. That makes it a very binary issue in terms of looking like it's either or. But in reality, it's not binary. It's a question of process and timing, if you will, and sequestration has some limits there, but a lot of flexibility that's often not talked about. So the Pentagon has tried to make it look like it's a black and white issue, but it's really not. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you've got the president clearly saying, I'm going to veto any change to the law. Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't have the Pentagon saying, we're not going to take sequestration, mm-hmm. and the president saying, I'm not going to take a change to sequestration. Something has to give.
Ryan, back in his next to last day in office, I had Deputy Defense Secretary Bill Lynn on the program, and he mentioned sequestration as something that, we really just will hate to deal with this. This will be something that will be hard for us to deal with. The sense that I took away from a lot of the other things that I've seen, in fact, from some of the work that you've done, is sequestration will force a top line on DOD, but it doesn't necessarily force them to spend that top line in any particular way in the budget lines underneath. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, it's interesting. There's actually a lot of railing around trying to figure out what the correct interpretation of the law is. The way it's stated in the Budget Control Act is that each account will be decreased by the same percentage. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you know, the accounts encompass lots of different programs. And so this looks like it's going to be different than when this process was started back in 1985, when we were looking at equal cuts to every program, project, or activity.
Mm-hmm. The idea of what some people call salami slices, where you take that equal number off the top, is not pleasurable, but we've seen over the years, I mean, anybody that's been paying attention to this issue for any period of time knows, you really, Bob Hale and his colleagues in finance at DOD have a lot of flexibility, as you mentioned, Dave, to be able to move amongst the money pots.
Right. I think the challenge there is not the flexibility, although the Pentagon is not actually publicly recognizing that flexibility. Mm-hmm. If you look at Secretary Panetta's letter to Senator McCain and Senator Graham, in which he had an attachment laying out the worst-case scenario, and one of the things he said is, if you put sequestration on top of the cuts we're already taking, You exempt military personnel and military pay, which is one of the things the president can do. You end up with a net 23% reduction to every program. That's not true, but that's what he says. Mm-hmm. And he says, I can't buy 77% of a ship. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. But this actually, the account is actually shipbuilding, construction, Navy. So you figure out which ship you're not going to buy and allocate the rest elsewhere. I think, though, there's a larger question that's missing from this discussion up to now, and that is, what exactly do we plan to use this military for? And that would be the framework that would allow you to figure out which one of those ships you're not going to buy if mm-hmm. you have to comply with it. Absent that framework, absent that vision, and the strategy they have today doesn't give you that vision, that makes the cuts much, much harder.
The structure of all of this is what I'm interested in. Later this afternoon, I'm going to talk to the program manager for the F-35 program at Lockheed. And I'm not going to ask you to comment specifically on the F-35 unless you want to, but that's kind of been the poster child, it seems, over the last couple of months for this whole conversation about what we need and what we don't need. The number of F-35s originally, I think, was going to be in the 300s, and now they're talking about significantly less than that. And it's the impetus for this conversation was, hey, Japan's going to buy four of these, and so this will make a big difference in the life cycle of the program. What has to happen for that conversation that you're suggesting, where we figure out what we really need or want to do and then figure out how to equip the military to do that?
The first thing that has to happen, and actually a little bit more time.
Mm-hmm.
We still have 90,000 troops deployed in Afghanistan, drawing down a few this month, the end of this year, going to take down another 23,000 or so next year. But really, until we're out of Afghanistan, it's very hard to step back and say, okay, what do we need to keep? What can we get rid of? The problem with sequestration is it doesn't give you that time. It takes effect January 2nd, 2013. And so in reality, what you would like is something that says, let's take a reduction in defense spending, but let's sequence it differently than what sequestration allows you to do.
The whole question of sequestration is, like many other things in this town, it's a political question at this right. point. And we have some members on both sides of the aisle saying, we're going to try to repeal this. You mentioned President Obama has said, I'm not going along with that. I'm going to veto any legislation that would repeal it, and it's going to be there. I covered event in the Capitol building last week that Congressman Van Hollen and other members said, wait a minute, you made a deal, speaking to particularly Republicans, but even some of his own colleagues that have talked about repealing sequestration, saying, nope, we cut a deal, we can't go back on a deal. And so this has the potential to turn into another one of these taffy pulls that we've had over the last several months. Do you see an end game there to give us a sense of what we really even should be thinking about a year or 2 years or 5 years out, or is that still very unclear to you?
There are several end games. There's another player in the room, though, that's not been there before. You know, this is really the fifth big budget drawdown we've had in defense since the end of World War II. So it's not as if we're not used to this, although it's about every 15 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a new player in the room that's never been there before, and that's the ratings agencies who are judging the bond rating of the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we were doing drawdowns after the Cold War, nobody said, what do Fitch's and Moody's and Standard & Poor's think about this? Today, in fact, if you look at the impact of the failure of the super committee, it had zero impact on the ratings agencies. Why? Because you still had the $1.2 trillion of cuts locked in by law under sequestration.
Mm-hmm.
If you start to tamper with that, they don't really care where that number comes from. They just care that it's there. You start to tamper with defense, you end up tampering with the number. Then you bring the ratings agencies into the equation. And that's unknown territory for us as a government.
And I've got to take a break, but when we come back, I want to pursue that a little bit because that's an angle that a lot of people in this world have not thought about. And there's maybe some nuances there that I'd like to explore. Dave Berteau and Ryan Crotty of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, my guest on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This is Pentagon Solutions. We'll continue in a moment.
Hi, welcome. welcome to Best Buy. Can I help you?
Yeah, my brother got an Insignia HD Radio Portable last month, and he really enjoys his workouts now.
Yep, HD Radio broadcasts are great. All kinds of new stuff on the HD2, HD3 channels.
And the Insignia HD Radio Portable is $49.99?
Yes, it's a great value.
Whoa, lead the way.
And did you know Insignia also offers an HD Radio Boombox for just $99?
Insignia HD Radio Receivers. Get them now at Best Buy. HD Radio. More radio, more value.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
I need some answers. September 3rd. I'm tired all the time. What's going on?
June 8th. I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
I'm Danny Tomlin, president of Associated Distributors, a distributor of wine and spirits and a member of the Charmer Sunbelt Group.
And I'm Governor Bob McDonnell. As we celebrate the holiday season with family and friends, please ensure everyone gets home safely by following these tips. If you host a party, provide plenty of non-alcoholic beverages for your guests and ensure no one under 21 drinks alcohol.
Plan ahead by designating a driver or arrange for alternative transportation. If you are 21 or older and choose to drink alcohol, please drink responsibly.
Have a joyous and safe holiday.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
The job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview. Yeah. And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The EPA has announced five winners for its Apps for the Environment Challenge. The agency designed the contest to help promote the creation of mobile apps that make innovative uses of EPA's own data. The top overall app the agency selected is a light bulb finder that lets mobile users weigh their lighting needs against financial considerations and the environmental impact of their choices. EPA also selected winners in categories created by students, and a winner for the most popular app as chosen by users.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
Wake up and drive in with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris on the Federal Drive. It's your early line on the day ahead from your trusted advisors. Tom and Amy give you a full view of the issues. Find out what your colleagues in other agencies are up to and what policy and congressional developments mean to you. The Federal Drive with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris. Weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Talking about sequestration on Pentagon Solutions today and the implications for budgeting and defense at the DOD on how sequestration might affect that. My guests from the Center for Strategic and International Studies are Ryan Crotty and David Berteau. And we were talking before the break, gentlemen, about the issue of credit ratings and the impact that credit ratings are having this time around on budget cuts at the Pentagon. Talk about what we're seeing. You mentioned something off the air, Dave, that I thought was interesting, and that is that when we went through the whole potential shutdown thing in April with the debt ceiling business, we actually came out of that with lower interest rates and more assets coming into U.S. bonds. And what you and I seemed to observe at the same time was it was because people were surprised that it wasn't more of a downgrade than it actually was. And at the same time, Europe was doing much worse than we were. What are the implications for that credit rating, specifically on DOD's budget and the sequestration process?
You look at what happened back in April, and most of your listeners will remember this. You know, Standard & Poor's gave us a slight downgrade in terms of U.S. bond rating.
Mm-hmm.
Fitch's and Moody's stayed the same. And you're right. Everybody actually expected it all to be worse. And because the rest of the world was in even worse shape at the time, we actually had an inflow of capital and a reduction in the interest rate we were having to pay. There's two impacts, though, I think, that flow from that in terms of long-term defense planning. One is the available money that the federal government will have, because if you look at the Congressional Budget Office projections now, they project that, in fact, the annual payment on the debt will pass up the amount we spend for defense later in this decade.
Mm-hmm.
That assumes a very historically, unrealistically low annual interest rate. And I don't have those numbers there. I have them probably somewhere I can show you during the next break. But as the part of the federal government that has to go to pay the debt, that's not discretionary. That's a mandatory funding. We have lived on low payments for a long time relative to the amount of debt we have.
Mm-hmm.
That will put a squeeze on defense just like any other growth in mandatory spending. And that's unaccounted for in anybody's projections, either Congressional Budget Office or the Office of Management and Budget.
Why do you think no one is accounting for that when it's common knowledge that that exists?
Well, historically, the Office of Management and Budget, of course, wants to have low interest rates projected because it always makes the president's package look good.
Mm-hmm.
The Congressional Budget Office typically has a more realistic assumption, but they have to have a basis for assuming something other than what's the case today.
Mm-hmm.
And they have no good analytical basis for projecting a change.
When you look at that, Ryan, that seems to be one of the biggest problems in all of this is we're in uncharted territory. The credit rating situation is one of the reasons for that, and there are others that we'll explore. But what does that do both for the government trying to figure out what's going to happen next and for you who researches this to try to help provide solutions for things like this?
Well, I think it really creates two problems. One is the uncertainty going forward. We're looking at a situation where all of the people that have to make decisions internal to the government don't even know how to talk to each other about this.
Mm-hmm.
And they're dealing with these political realities, in which case they're almost being encouraged to not talk about the realities in order to hold the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's somewhat of a dangerous situation when we start looking at all the brinksmanship we have going on, that we're getting to these brinks without having any idea of where we go on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Ryan uses the term...
Francis, I want to add something to that.
Sure.
I mean, I'm a management and budget guy. I don't know politics all that well. But again, going back to what Standard & Poor's actually said in the downgrade, the reason they downgraded is not because we didn't reach a deal,
mm-hmm.
but because they saw that the political dynamic left too much uncertainty in there.
Right.
I don't know how you price political uncertainty into a federal budget.
Well, and how you price it into economies overall is what we're seeing in the stock markets in Europe, because nobody knows what will happen. And it's not just the countries that are affected by debt problems.
Right.
We're seeing it on the FTSE in England, and we're seeing it in the exchanges in Germany and France, which are the two countries that are expected to finance the other countries in Europe that are struggling.
Sure. What was the real economic lesson of the financial crisis of 2008? It was not that we ended up with 10% unemployment and a loss of a third of our value of our TSP. It was, in fact, that we could not bound how far the consequences would reach or who would be touched by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that level of uncertainty is going to be with us probably forever.
All right. One other element of this that we talked about a little bit during the break is the situation with contracts. And you have this chart, and we're going to link to the online version of this at federalnewsradio.com. But tell me about this chart of top-line DOD contract spending from 1990 to 2010. It's a 20-year period. And you pointed out something that I thought was particularly incisive before we went on the air, Dave.
We track federal contract spending at CSIS, and we put out a series of annual reports. This particular one looks at the Defense Department and where it spends its contract dollars. But we put it in the context of overall defense outlays. What we found, and this was very much a surprise to me, is that if you divide the entire Defense Department budget into two categories, that money that's spent on contracts and that money that's spent on non-contracts, which is typically pay and benefits of military and civilian personnel, a few other things, the part that's spent not on contracts but on personnel in constant year dollars, FY10 dollars in the case of that particular chart, is almost the same in 2010 as it was in 1990, roughly $290 billion a year in FY10 dollars. The force is one-third smaller, so you're actually paying more per soldier by a wide margin. But the total amount of dollars, the growth has been in the part of the defense budget that goes to contracts, which has almost doubled in the last 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at where you're going to take your cuts, you really only have two choices. I'm either going to take my cuts in people, and the only way you do that is to get rid of people, mm-hmm. or I'm going to take my cuts in contracts. And the contracts, having been the area of growth, are likely to be the target of reductions.
And that's where the Chris Van Hollens of the world and the Chuck Schumers of the world have been saying, listen, we're quite satisfied, quite content with the state of our military in September 10th, 2001, and we were spending this amount. Why would it hurt us to go back to that level, only reshaping how we're doing that spending? That, looking at this chart, that seems to be somewhat of a convincing argument for that.
It's potentially a convincing argument. For that, you have to recognize two other realities. One is that the biggest growth in that contract spending has not been in products or hardware or weapon systems, but in services.
Mm-hmm.
And the services contracts tend not to be top-down directed with a big program manager for all Air Force services, for instance. They're bottom-up decisions made by every post-camp and station and activity across the Defense Department all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to manage those bottom-up decisions with a top-down structure, particularly when they're largely funded by operation and maintenance funding, which is a central account that's, that has no built-in controls for it.
So which needs switch, the bottom-up process by which most of those services are procured, or the top-down management style that doesn't really have a handle on how that bottom-up structure works?
The only way you can get at this effectively is actually to do some of both.
Hmm.
You need clearer guidance from the top down that says, here's where you need to stop doing something. Because ultimately, you know, you look at what Secretary Gates did. I know you've had a couple shows on his efficiency initiatives back over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And what he basically said was, take fewer people, take less contract support, but keep doing everything you're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can only go so far down that path before you, in fact, saturate yourself,
yeah.
right? Eventually, you got to identify something that you can stop doing. The history of defense reductions, the history actually of government reductions for efficiency purposes is we take the money out of the budget, and then we ask people to figure out how to comply with that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the top-down approach, but you need to give them guidance as to what it's okay to stop doing.
That's the whole idea of less is more, and we're not just hearing that, Ryan, in DOD. We're hearing that all across government, where the expectation is you're going to have fewer dollars, you're going to have fewer people, and your mission is going to stay exactly the same. Are we getting a sense that there's anybody on either side of the aisle in Congress who's willing to say, here are the aspects of our national defense that the DOD is currently providing that we're willing to do without because you're going to have fewer dollars and fewer people potentially? Or is it all stretch what you've got and keep doing what you're doing as best you can?
Well, there definitely seems to be the sense that they really want us to be able to do everything that we've been doing this whole time, and just with less money, but also with less hardware, mm-hmm. with older hardware. And yet there has not been a serious discussion, whether in the QDR or, you know, the upcoming roles and missions review, anything that indicates that anyone's willing to take a stance on what the real trade-offs are and what we should be thinking about as being maybe no longer a critical piece of our national security.
When we come back, I'm going to do another quick break. Go ahead.
Ultimately, there's only four ways you can cut. You can cut your operations,
mm-hmm.
you can cut your people, you can cut your overhead, or you can cut your equipment that you're buying. And I think when we come back, we ought to look at those four areas and see where we stand in each of those.
Definitely, I want to do that. And I also want to try to break this down on how much of the responsibility here lies with Congress and how much of the responsibility lies with DOD, either to go to Congress and say, this is what we would like to see happen, or to try to work with Congress after they've done a little bit of dictation, so to speak, and execute whatever marching orders they have, no pun intended. My guests are Dave Berteaux and Ryan Crotty from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, talking about the implications and fallout of sequestration. We'll continue our conversation in a moment.
This is Lisa Millman from AFMA. For all military service members and veterans, there's no better place to go for your life insurance needs than AFMA. Our level term to age 50 policy is only $19 per month for $400,000 of coverage. And each member's policy comes with AFMA's unique survivor assistance services. For a free quote on life insurance, call 1-877-398-2263 or visit AFMA.com. That's AAFMAA.com.
Federal News Radio is a proud partner of FEA, the Federal Employees Education and Assistance Fund. In the past 25 years, FEA has helped more than 21,000 federal families with over $18 million in aid. By donating just $1 per pay period, you can help federal families keep the lights on, clean up after a natural disaster, or send a kid to college. Keep your CFC dollars in the federal family and make your pledge to FEA 11185 today. Learn more at FEA.org. That's FEEA.org.
To win and deliver government contracts successfully, you need to align with the right teaming partners. Meet Tech Systems. While often behind the scenes, Tech Systems has worked with government agencies and systems integrators for over 25 years. In fact, every year, they deploy over 70,000 IT professionals at over 5,500 client sites nationwide, including more than 65 government agencies. Tech Systems is active across a broad spectrum of government programs and has developed deep relationships to understand what works well and who does it best. Thinking about cybersecurity, working on a cloud computing initiative. Tech Systems addresses critical program gaps related to people, projects, and work functions. Their delivery models scale from staff augmentation to IT project and outsourcing services to support transition, ramp-up, surge, and ongoing program support needs. Learn more at TechSystems.com. TEKSystems.com.
This holiday season, give the gift that money can't buy. When you donate blood with the American Red Cross, you give the perfect gift. Another hug, another laugh, another smile, another chance to someone in need of blood. And unlike the latest fashion trend, video game, or golf club, the perfect gift costs nothing but an hour of your time. Visit RedCrossBlood.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS to schedule an appointment today. Give the gift of life and help unwrap a lifetime of memories for patients in need.
Caregivers Self-Care. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. If you're giving care to a family member who is seriously ill, it's also important to take care of yourself. Being a family caregiver is a big job that often comes on top of other work and home responsibilities, so it's important to watch your stress. Recreation therapy specialist Renee Stubbs works at the National Institutes of Health's Clinical Center. She sees family caregivers all the time and tries to be a support for them as they care for their loved ones undergoing treatment at the research hospital.
I encourage them to make sure that they do things that are self-sustaining and self-caring. Relaxation. Make sure you're eating properly. Make sure you're getting enough rest and sleep.
Learn more at HHS.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
With the new year comes resolutions, when we resolve to stop snacking and slacking, resolve to start reading and running. This year, resolve to help someone else too. Resolve to support the American Red Cross, because the Red Cross provides hope, help, and compassion not only during disasters, but every day. Resolve to do something that means something. Support the American Red Cross before the new year. Visit RedCross.org today.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests are David Berteau and Ryan Crotty of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, talking about sequestration on Pentagon Solutions today, the implications for sequestration on DOD budgeting and national defense. And we talked about your chart in the last segment where you outline the just dramatic increase in contract spending over the last 20 years. And we'll link that up, as I mentioned, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It is from the Defense Contracting Trends, DOD Contract Spending and the Supporting Industrial Base, a brief from CSIS, available online. And you said, Dave, that essentially you've got four areas where these cuts can happen if they're going to happen. Review those four for us again, and we'll talk about them individually.
Right. Basically, you know, if you're going to cut defense, you can cut people in strength, military in strength, and civilian payroll. You can cut operations, the support for the war that's going on, or the we used to call it two wars, but I think one's officially over now. The last guy left.
Yep, within the last week or so.
You can cut, in fact, overhead, which is what a company would typically do if it were facing reductions. Mm-hmm. Or you can cut the equipment that you're buying, your investment accounts, your research and development and procurement dollars for the future. Let's quickly look at each of those. You can't really cut operations that much. I mean, we are going to come down in the supplemental. The overseas contingency operations account will come down substantially in the fiscal year 13 budget. But you can't really cut the force structure that much of the military until you've actually brought them home and know you're not going to send them back. You can't cut operations and personnel that much. The problem with cutting overhead is there's no line item in the budget that says overhead.
Right.
You know, in a commercial company, you actually have a line item for overhead. But in the government, there's no line item for overhead. And I think for defense, it's even more than that. Overhead is where the military lives when they're not fighting a war. So to them, it's not overhead at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's their natural state.
Mm-hmm.
It's what they'd like to be all the time because they don't live to fight wars. They live to prevent wars.
Mm-hmm.
So the only place you have left to cut is contracts and the investment account, procurement and research and development. And that might not be the most balanced way to go forward.
As you look at what we're buying, the equipment part of it, I think, is the element that interests me the most because there, I think, are compelling arguments on both sides. I have an 11-year-old son, and, you know, with the flag flying in the background as I'm saying this, you know, I want to live in a safe country and the most powerful country in the world, and I want to pass it on to my son and all that. I understand all that. When I hear some of the anecdotal things that I hear, that you've researched much more than I have, and maybe you can put some numbers and some facts behind this concept, when I hear that if we cut a certain piece of equipment by X percent, we'll still have X percent more than every other country in the world put together. I hear those kinds of things, and I think there's got to be some room in the equipment numbers for that. Ryan, you're smiling as I say that. Do you have some – can you put some data to my concept?
in at least part of it. We actually looked – we were doing a comparison between the previous drawdown – after the end of the Cold War and today, and looked at some of these major platform numbers. Now, I can't compare them to other countries besides the anecdotal things that I've heard as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's fair to say that most people would say we have the most technologically superior armed forces and that we've been able to more or less successfully run two wars at the same time in terms of our equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you look at our major platforms, this is a comparison between the end of the Cold War and these numbers are from 2008, but we have almost 60% fewer strategic bombers than we had then. We have 50% less tanks, 50% less principal surface ships, 50% fewer submarines, 45% fewer rotary aircraft, 30% fewer fighters. Now, of course, you can argue whether or not this is because some of these things are no longer important to warfare for today. And certainly there are a lot of things that aren't captured there that we do today that didn't even exist then,
right.
UAVs and such things. But it's fair to say that we still have a lot of all those things, even though we are far, far below where we were back in that period. But I think it brings up another point. You talked about taking away from investment accounts being the natural place where it's easy to cut, and that's how we did it last time.
Uh-huh.
We cut right out of the investment accounts. But that's because throughout the 1980s, we had major modernization programs, huge spending on recapitalizing our force. And while we have actually spent more on procurement over the past 10 years than we did in the last buildup, we didn't do a lot to actually modernize the hardware that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the arguments that the Pentagon has been trying to make. I think realistically that, you know, now they have even older stuff that's more used because, mm-hmm. You know, it actually, unlike the Cold War, it was actually saw a lot of use.
Yeah.
And that does create a problem when you might think that, well, the biggest thing we need is to, modernize, and the easiest thing to cut is the money to modernize.
Yeah. Every single time that somebody like Senator McCain stands up and criticizes the F-35 program, it's obviously not event for event, but the Buck McKeons of the world say, nope, can't touch any of that stuff. We need all of this. And I guess I go back to what you talked about earlier, Dave, and that is the idea that somebody needs to decide, first of all, what we do. And it seems to me that's what the QDR is for. Go back to the QDR and say, these are all the things that we expect over the next 4 years to do. Certainly there are bright minds at the Pentagon that could take it out another 4 to 40 years to try to figure out where we're headed from there. And use that as a framework. Why is that such a hard concept for people to wrap their minds around? Is it all political stuff?
No, it's not all political, and it actually is quite difficult. You know, I'm struck by the fact that you can pick up the Pentagon's report on China and get a pretty good write-up of where we expect China to be in 2030.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually more detail in that report about where we think China will be in 2030 with their military capability than there is in our own QDR about where we will be in 2030. Now, mm-hmm. I'm delighted that we have a good idea where China's going to be, but you'd like to have at least the same level of precision for yourself. What it requires you to do, though, and this is why it's so difficult, is it requires you to assume that some things are more important than others and some things are less important than others.
But isn't that how you and Ryan and I all do our budgets at home? Now, I know that's simplistic, but isn't it the same concept? Doesn't that concept scale?
That's exactly the case. Now, if you look at the history of the military and the way they play the drawdowns is they really don't want to do a long-term plan. They want to do it 1 year at a time, just in case something happens, 9/11, and the budget comes back again.
Mm-hmm.
Because the truth is, we knew at the start of every drawdown that it had started, but in none of those cases could we say when the drawdown was going to end and the next buildup was going to start.
Mm-hmm.
And so the military want to hedge their bets and be prepared to make that turn and start coming back up at a moment's notice in case it's needed. That mitigates against a long-term plan for the drawdown.
But another thing that it seems to me that healthy organizations do is they have either an emergency fund or they have access to funds to do that emergency. The United States certainly can leverage that kind of thing. That in the event, I mean, and we've been doing it with supplementals for the past however long. That mechanism exists that we could do this in, and the administration has said, stop doing that when it comes to the supplementals. Start getting ready to pay for all of this stuff out of the regular budget. So that mechanism exists that we could switch back to a kind of standard operating procedure, I would think, fairly quickly, within several years.
Absolutely. And the Pentagon has the best developed set of tools in the federal government for doing this. The Future Year Defense Program, the FYDP, has been around since the dawn of McNamara's time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for most of the history of DOD since then, over the last 50 years, that Future Year Defense Program has been fiscally disciplined, and it has laid out in it and forced choices 3, 4, 5, 6 years from now. The problem is over the last decade, it's fallen into disuse, both because the buildup was what was dominating, or the increase of expenses. It wasn't really a buildup, as Ryan pointed out. We didn't get more stuff, but we spent a lot more money. And because if you had a problem inside the base budget, you fix that problem by paying for it out of the supplementals or out of the Overseas Contingency Operations Account, the OCO. Now that you're putting OCO back into base, you have to reactivate that fiscally disciplined Future Year Defense Program. The problem is we've lost touch with how to do that. We're out of practice. You can't find any colonels today, or very many civilians, who actually remember how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I said the military have a propensity to say we want to preserve our options and keep our flexibility open. This is where it's important for the Secretary of Defense and the key roles of the Office of the Secretary of Defense to force them out of that mentality into a let's make the trade-offs and document them.
And so the fact that we have a SecDef that is a former Budget Committee chairman and former OMB director, we should maybe think of as a positive, I would think.
You would think that he comes well prepared to recognize this reality, particularly since he was OMB director mm-hmm. at the time of the key parts of the last budget drawdown decision. So he certainly got the experience base in the background to be able to do that. But that requires you to make visible trade-offs beyond the election.
All right. I want to talk about that when we come back, and I want to hit on a couple of more things in super committee fallout and implications for defense piece that's on CSIS.org and linked up at federalnewsradio.com. When we come back, my guests on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, Dave Berteau and Ryan Crotty of CSIS, and we'll continue in a moment.
American company creating American jobs with American pride? That's Hyundai.
You come in with a great attitude. You're happy to be at work.
I am happy to be here. I'm proud to be here.
This is the highest paying job I've ever had.
Good wages. Great wages.
The benefits are great.
I love the pay and benefits.
The benefits of working at Hyundai are awesome.
Hyundai is building more than cars. We're rebuilding pride in America.
This is not just a job. This is a career. We have a career here.
I feel a sense of pride. I feel a sense of accomplishment, something that we all can rejoice in because we've done this together.
They allow you to grow with the company. That is Hyundai. That's the difference.
I love the people. They're extraordinary.
Working with pride. Working at Hyundai.
Let me tell you, I've got a sense of pride.
I love my job.
Proud partner in the American dream. Dream with us at HyundaiAmerica.us.
Hyundai is an all-American success story.
Hyundai. New thinking. New possibilities.
We raise high for GW basketball. Some raise high with the jump out of your seat, buzzer beating, hands to the sky scream. Others give their all in the GW fight song, Raising High the Buff and Blue. Raising High is more than just a movement. It's the movement for Colonials basketball, where senators and students, friends and families come together for the thrill of victory. Raise High with GW Basketball today. Call 202-994-7325 or visit gwsports.com now.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Dean Hunter is the Deputy Director of Facility Security and Contracting at OPM.
When the National Weather Service forecast an inch of snow or any amount of ice to affect the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, that kicks off our protocols to conduct a COG conference call. We kick off the call at 3 a.m. We get on a secondary conference call with OPM senior staff. Our goal is to get that decision out no later than 4 a.m.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
Here's Frank Konechny, the CTO of the U.S. Air Force, on the Federal Executive Forum on Emerging Technologies, sponsored by Sourcefire.
As we come out with more devices, we have to be able to send the data to that device. And so what you're going to see someone who's more of an IP cellular network in the sky, where we're all going to interlink with each other. But again, security, data, big data, quick response time, and the devices are all key essential elements that we are going to see in the future.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
As you listen to this, hackers from around the world are trying to access your agency's IT network. Don't let your network be compromised by fighting today's cyber threats with yesterday's technology. Government agencies trust SourceFire's next-generation security to manage cyber threats, control applications, and keep their data safe. SourceFire provides its customers with agile security to combat today's most sophisticated threats. Download a free next generation intrusion prevention system white paper at sourcefire.com/federal.
Giving you the edge on healthy living. Here's Mayo Clinic Medical Edge.
I looked down and could see that my uniform was torn pretty bad and I was bleeding pretty badly. When I woke up after surgery, I had a doc come in and tell me that both legs were gone.
Now, Staff Sergeant Heath Calhoun has new legs, computerized prosthetics that allow him to walk, run, even play golf.
For people who have bilateral above-knee amputations, a 25-year follow-up of Vietnam veterans showed that only 22% of them we're actually up and walking with prosthetics.
Mayo Clinic Dr. Kenton Kaufman says that's often because it's a challenge to learn to walk with two above-knee amputations. But the new computerized legs are smart. They can sense when to lock or when to swing freely. Newer models are getting even smarter, and that should help even more people get back into the walk of life. For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org. I'm Tracy McCray.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests are Ryan Crotty and Dave Berteau from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we're talking on Pentagon Solutions today about the implications of sequestration for operations at DOD and national security and national defense issues. I guess what this whole conversation really boils down to about sequestration is, and Ryan, I'll start with you. Is this really doomsday or is this not doomsday? Is there some middle ground in between where the we have to cut defense people stand and where the Buck McKeons of the world stand?
Well, I think David alluded to this earlier, but I think the real hard and fast problem with sequestration is the timing question.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting $55 billion from the defense budget is not that hard. But it's pretty darn hard next year.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard when we haven't had the chance to even have the conversations about what we were talking about earlier, about whether, you know, what we want to be able to do or what we're willing to take off the table. I think that the big question is more about not the level of cuts, but how we actually go about doing it, the actual process, as opposed to the concept of this, you know, $1.2 trillion total, $500 billion from defense.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to execute what you don't plan for.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the Pentagon is not planning to execute any of the sequestration cuts. So the likelihood that they can do it well is pretty slim. But what's going to force them to start planning? It's got to be guidance from the president. And the president has not given them that guidance.
So the big shoulders here, it sounds like, are President Obama, the House and Senate Armed Services Committees, the Appropriations Committees, and so on. So there's not a whole lot of names on that list, and certainly neither party is immune either. There are folks on both sides of the aisle that really need to be on this, and it doesn't sound like really anybody has given an indication that they're up to the heavy lifting just yet.
You asked earlier sort of where does the responsibility for that lie, mm-hmm. and obviously it's shared between the legislative and executive branches, and the framers of the Constitution designed it to be that way. But ultimately, the burden falls first on the Defense Department to figure out what they need and to put that into their budget proposal,
mm-hmm.
and then it's up to Congress to change it or tweak it, if you will. One of the things that I think is important here, though, comparing DOD to the rest of the federal government, is who's the ultimate user of what they spend their money on? And most of the rest of the federal government, the ultimate users are actually outside the agency itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for defense, almost everything it spends its money on, it consumes itself to defend the nation.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of why they're there. But it puts a different framework, if you will, of I'm going to actually suffer the consequences of my reductions. They will be in my own home territory, if you will.
You mentioned your list of four potential cut areas earlier on: people, operations, overhead, and equipment. Is there any room, and we talk primarily about equipment as the place to cut, is there any room that is of any significance in any of those other areas? One I'll throw out, for example, is increasing premiums in TRICARE.
Absolutely.
All that seemed to do was make a whole bunch of people that are in service right now mad. The number, the way it would affect the top line didn't seem to be tremendously significant.
No, but it was hugely important from a symbolic point of view.
Okay.
And actually, we just at CSIS just finished another study on the growth in personnel costs, military personnel costs in the Defense Department over the last decade. I'll send you the link to that.
Great.
You can connect it as well.
Sure.
And what we found was that, it had grown without any set of comprehensive way of thinking about it, if you will. And a lot of those benefits are not actually for the military who are fighting the wars, but for the retirees and those who have long separated.
Mm-hmm.
I think what it's going to take, though, the symbolic value of the copay on TRICARE, which whether the votes are in, ultimately end up being there or not, is that it raises the issue of, yes, the growth here has been too much. We need a constraint. It's hard to get the votes, especially while you're in a war that says, oh, we're not going to give another benefit to the military.
Sure.
But what it needs is a comprehensive approach that looks at the package in total. Ultimately, if you're depending on an all-volunteer force, what you need to know is, how much do I need to be compensating these people in order to sustain the quality and the capability of the force that we have?
And I wonder if some of the same thoughts, Ryan, that apply to people across government don't apply here, too. Catherine Medina of the Office of Personnel Management's Chief Human Capital Officers Council was on the program yesterday, and she said that repeated studies have demonstrated that the reason people stay in the federal government on the civilian side is not because of the money they make. It's because of the sense of patriotism that they have. It's because of the fulfillment they get from knowing that they're doing the country's work, and that kind of thing. And certainly I'm not suggesting that anybody should or will vote in favor of cutting pay or cutting benefits for the troops, but we seem to have gotten to a point where what Dave is talking about of how much does it take to keep the folks that we have and bring other people in isn't the conversation anymore.
Right. It's something that now almost becomes a political question,
right?
Where you can never say no because it makes you look bad,
mm-hmm.
and that's understandable because these are the people that are sacrificing. But then again, you know, we're looking at a period where a lot of people are going to have to be making sacrifices, and so I wonder, you know, we look at the last 10 years and the expansion is so large in terms of compensation and benefits. Compared to the general static size of the actual end strength, that, you know, these questions of retention and recruitment have become pretty much ignored.
Troops have increased by 4% since 9/11. The pay and benefits have increased in constant dollar terms, adjusted for inflation, by 58%. That's a phenomenal difference.
What is driving that?
What's driving that is the absolute insistence of every politician to never say no to a request,
mm-hmm.
and to actually increase it. DOD will propose a 2.5% pay raise. Congress ups it to 3. You know, now there is one other area of cuts that's worth mentioning before we close out the show, and that's the overhead side.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there you have things like base closures, which clearly reduces your overhead. The lead time is long. The earliest you could possibly do an effective round of base closures, even if you forget about Mark Center and all the anomalies that came out of 2005, would be probably 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't take the money now. And this is, again, where sequestration falls into the trap of, I got to cut before I'm ready in areas I can't define.
Well, that might work out. 2017 is just in time for auditability. So that'll work out great, right?
It'll give me more candidates than we ever had.